sun was even fully up. Irene yanking on the starter of the outboard motor, then Irene driving the boat to the spot where the smallmouth bass were biting. Irene had indeed taught both Baker and Cash to cast. She had shown them how to reel in a fish after they felt a tug on the line. She had deftly worked the hook from the fish's mouth, using one gloved hand to hold the fish and one hand to maneuver her Gerber tool. Irene could snap fishing line with her teeth. She could fillet a bass or a perch so expertly that there were no bones to worry about when it came off the charcoal grill that evening at dinner. Baker had forgotten that his mother liked to fish, but even now that he remembers, he wonders if this is really what she wants to do for a living. Maybe she needs a break, a respite, a time to recharge and reset. Maybe that's what they all need. On the minus side, Cash says, we'll be grown men living with our mother. Sexy, Baker says. But the house is big, Cash says. The house is big, Baker says. And it'll be nice to have an extra person to watch Floyd. He won't mention that, however, lest Cash call him a self-involved bastard. Later that night, Baker wants to go out. The dishes are done, and Baker has read to Floyd and tucked him in. Baker also showed him how their bedrooms connect. The house feels more familiar this time around. Baker finds Cash collapsed in a heap in front of a basketball game. He considers slipping out the door. He needs to go to town. He needs to see Ayers. But he can't just leave with Floyd asleep upstairs. Hey, Cash. Yeah? Cash doesn't move his eyes from the TV. I'm going out for a little while, man, Baker says, or I'd like to. If you could just keep one ear open in case Floyd wakes up. Yeah, of course, Cash says. Baker lets his breath go. Are you going into town to see Ayers? Cash asks. Baker considers lying, but what can he say? That he's going to the grocery store? Out for a nightcap? Cash will know better. Yeah, Baker admits. She asked about you today on the hike, Cash says. Baker's heart feels like a speeding car without brakes. She did? She said you didn't call her after you left. Cash pauses. Were you really that stupid? Yes, Baker thinks he was. There had been dozens of times when Baker thought to reach out, but honestly, he hadn't seen the point. He had been stuck in Houston until Anna announced she was leaving. I was that stupid, Baker says. My guess is she has a thing for you, Cash says. Don't mess it up. Cash's tone indicates that he fully believes Baker will mess it up. It's true that Baker's track record with women hasn't been great. He chose to marry a woman who didn't love him, who may or may not have liked men at all. But Ayers is different. It's as though Baker had been on a quest without even realizing it, until he found exactly what he was looking for. He's not going to mess it up. Baker wonders why Cash is being so cool about Ayers. He seems relaxed and at ease in a way that is very un-Cash-like. Maybe it's some kind of trap. Or maybe the island is working its magic. Thanks, man, Baker says. I mean it, Cash. Thank you. Good luck, Cash says. Good luck. Baker turns up the radio in the Jeep. The excellent station out of San Juan, 104.3 The Buzz, is playing the Chili Peppers. Baker sings along, woefully off-key, but who cares? He's got the windows open and the sweet night air is rushing in. Baker hasn't felt this sense of freedom, this sense of possibility, since he was in high school. He's nervous. He has butterflies. He drives into town at 10:30 and things are still lively. It's Saturday night. He worries that to see Ayers, he'll have to go to La Tapa for a drink. He really wanted to be sober and clear-headed tonight. But then he spots her leaving the restaurant, wearing cut-off jean shorts and a t-shirt and a pair of chucks, a suede bag hitched over her shoulder. She reaches up and releases her hair from its bun. She is so strong and composed and self-possessed, Baker is dazzled. He has been dazzled by women before, of course. When he watched Anna pull a splinter out of Floyd's foot with one quick, precise movement. When his old girlfriend Trinity knotted a cherry stem with her tongue. Baker still doesn't understand how people do that. But Ayers is different. She's flawless. Baker drives up alongside her and rolls the window down. He thinks about trying to be funny. Hey, little girl, want some candy? But there's no way he'll be able to pull it off. Ayers, he says. Hi. She stops, ducks her head to peer into the car. They lock eyes. Baker, she says. She holds his gaze, and the two of them knit together somehow. He can't speak, so he nods his head toward the passenger seat. She runs around the front of the car, opens the door, climbs in, and fastens her seatbelt. Wow, she says. I can't believe I'm doing this. Where to? He asks. Hawk's Nest Beach, she says. I'll show you the way. Rosie. February 22nd, 2006. I'm afraid to write down exactly what happened with Russ, but I'm afraid not to write it down because what if I forget and my weekend with him is washed away like a heart drawn in the sand? There was sex, a lot of sex, and it was the best sex of my life, but I have only Oscar to compare it to, and if there's one thing I can say about Oscar, it's that he's selfish and greedy and arrogant, and any time I opened my mouth to ask him to change his style, he took offense and kept on doing things the same way, because in his mind, he knew the path to my pleasure better than I did. I faked a lot with Oscar. I faked so much that I got quite skilled at it, and I assumed I would have to fake it with Russell from Iowa City because, well, let's just say he was older and grayer and not at all in shape. But man, was I surprised at how good he was to me. He was gentle and firm and confident when he touched my body, and he was also appreciative, maybe even reverent. The sex was so sublime that I started to feel both jealous of and guilty about his wife, Irene. At one point, I said to Russ, I hope your wife knows how lucky she is to have you. Russ laughed. I doubt she would describe herself that way. And not that you asked, but my wife and I don't have sex like this. We don't have sex much at all. Like I said, in Irene's eyes, I'm a day late and a dollar short in nearly everything I do. Her main attitude toward me is weary disappointment, which kind of kills the magic. On Saturday night, I sneaked out of his room at 3 o'clock in the morning and got back to Jacob's Ladder at 3:30. I somehow managed to get in the house without waking Mama, who was a very light sleeper. Russ and I had planned to spend the day together on Sunday, but I had to be careful, so careful, because the island has eyes and very loose lips. Turns out, Russ's friend and potential new boss, Todd Croft, had left behind the skiff from the yacht for Russ to use, although Russ admitted he didn't feel comfortable navigating in unfamiliar waters. Leave the driving to me, I said. I was off all day Sunday and Sunday night, so I went to church with Mama, which normally I hated, but I needed to ask forgiveness for the sins I had already committed, as well as the ones I was about to commit. I told Mama I was going to Salomon Bay for the day, then straight to a barbecue, and I'd be home late. Mama said, You got home late last night, mon chou. She uses the French phrases that she picked up in Paris when she's displeased. It's a signal I alone understand. I want you to tell me right now that you are not back involved with Oscar. I've heard he's been sniffing around. Estella must have been talking to Deary, who did my mother's hair. I faced her on the stone walk outside the Catholic church and said, Mama, I am not involved with Oscar. Her expression was dubious, but my words contained conviction. Better not be, she said. Even though we were traveling over water, which was a lot safer than land, I had to be sneaky. I left my car at the National Park Service sign as though I had indeed headed to Salomon Bay, but instead I hiked down to the public part of Honeymoon Beach and cut through the back way so that I popped out of the trees in a place where I could wade to the skiff, which I did, holding my bag above my head. Russ was waiting for me with a cooler and a picnic basket he'd asked the hotel to pack. I started the motor on the first try, and we were off. It was an idyllic day. The water sparkled in the sun. The air had a rare, scrubbed clean feel, as though it had just received a benediction. It was as fine a performance by planet Earth as I had ever seen. Russ had on bathing trunks, a long-sleeved t-shirt, and a baseball cap that said Iowa City Elks Lodge, which made me chuckle because, really, what was I doing with this guy? And yet I liked him. Just as I thought I had him pegged as one kind of person, he had just ended his second term on the Iowa City School Board. He was encouraging his mother, Millie, to move into a retirement community, but she was having none of it. He would pull out a surprise, like the way he stroked behind my knee in a spot so sweet and sensitive, I had a hard time concentrating. We anchored off of Little Cinnamon because the cliff above was undeveloped, so no one would be spying on us with binoculars for voyeuristic purposes. Russ unpacked the cooler. There was a nice bottle of Sancerre for me, the Chavignol, which I loved, and a couple of cold beers for Russ. There were slender baguette sandwiches with duck, arugula, and fig jam, and as I ate one, all I could think of was Remy the chef preparing them, having no idea that one was for me. There was also a container of truffled potato salad and a couple of lemon tarts, and I thought of how nice it was to be on the receiving end of Keneal's hospitality for once. We puttered along the north shore as far as Water Lemon Key, where we stopped again because, although we hadn't brought snorkeling gear, you could watch turtles pop their heads above the surface for air, and Russ loved that. It was hot enough that we both decided to jump in for a swim, and Russ held me in the water, his arms incredibly strong for a corn syrup salesman or whatever he was. We kissed, and I thought, what are we doing here at Water Lemon Key when we have a perfectly good hotel room? I said, do you think you'll take the job?
It's hard to say no. The signing bonus is nearly as much as I make in a year right now.
If you take the job, will you spend more time down here? Unfortunately, my voice betrayed what I was really asking. Would I ever see him again? I was afraid the answer would be no. I was afraid the answer would be yes. What we were doing was wrong. He was married with two sons in high school, and he must have been trying not to imagine what they would think if they could see him at that moment. But it was as if we were living in a sealed bubble. One weekend in February in the sixth year of the new millennium, this happened. I had a vague idea that affairs like this could actually improve a marriage. Russ would return to Iowa City with not only a big job offer, but also a sense of power and virility, and Irene would see him in a new light. They would renew their vows, go on a second honeymoon. And for me? Well, things wouldn't be awful for me either. I had faith in men again. The ghost of Oscar was permanently banished. Every time I thought of him helpless and whimpering in Russ's grip, I thought, how pathetic. I would venture forth with my self-esteem and self-worth restored. I would meet someone like Russ, kind, thoughtful, secure, adult, and that would blossom into the relationship that this could never be. Our affair would be almost excusable if this all turned out to be the case. But even as I had these pretty and nice thoughts about us both going our own ways after this without any looking back, I felt my heart stirring up trouble. Maybe Russ was experiencing the same thing, because he looked genuinely crestfallen as he said,
"You know, I'm really not sure. I know there will be travel with this job, but I think it'll be in dull places like Palm Beach and Midland, Texas. I think Todd just brought me down here to woo me."
"Okay," I said, trying to keep my tone light and unconcerned. "Let's go back to the hotel then, and properly enjoy the time we have left." We did just that, and it was wonderful. Not only the sex, but also falling asleep in that luscious bed with our limbs intertwined. When I woke up, He was staring at me just like the leading man in the movies looks at his leading lady, right before he betrays her, or kills her, or carries her off into the sunset.
"You're exquisite," he said. "And just now, watching you sleep, I felt so privileged, like I've been granted a private viewing of the Mona Lisa."
"Everyone says the Mona Lisa is so beautiful," I said. "But frankly, I don't get it." This made Russ laugh, and he reached over to the nightstand and plucked a pale pink hibiscus blossom out of the water glass. He tucked it behind my ear.
"You're right," he said. "You're far prettier than the Mona Lisa."
I swatted him to downplay how happy that made me. Show me a woman who doesn't like being compared to a masterpiece. Then said, "I'm starving." It was dark outside. The bedside clock said 9:20. It was too late to get dinner anywhere on this sleepy island, besides which I was basically in hiding. So we ordered room service, lavishly, recklessly, like we were rock stars on the last leg of a world tour. One bacon cheeseburger, one lobster pizza, French fries, a Caesar salad, the key lime pie, a hot fudge sundae, and, of course, conch fritters, because now that was our thing. I would never see Russell Steele again, but every time I put in an order of conch fritters, I would think of him. I told him this, and he threw me down on the bed and said,
"God, Rosie, how can I ever leave you? I'm different now. In such a short time, I'm changed."
He was putting words to what I felt as well. I had tears in my eyes as I tried to control my crazy runaway heart. "Don't leave me," I nearly said, which would have been pathetic after a relationship of only 24 or 48 hours, depending on how you looked at it. But I was saved from myself by a knock at the door. It was room service with our food, which I knew would be delivered by Woodrow, so I had to go hide in the bathroom while Russ answered the door. I stayed overnight Sunday. Todd Croft and the other guy, the company lawyer Stephen, were due to pick Russ up at noon. I had been up since dawn, worrying about how the goodbye would go, and I even brazenly wandered out to the beach where I saw my donkeys stop, drop, and roll, eating grass at the edge of the beach. I decided to take their presence as a positive omen. This is my home. This is where I belong. And I need to find someone who calls St. John home as well. The reason that getting involved with a married man is wrong is that it hurts. I knew that if it continued 1 minute past noon today, it would be destructive. What did I want Russ to do? Go home and tell his wife that he was leaving her for some woman half his age with whom he'd had a fling in the Caribbean? Hell no. We lay in bed together until the last possible minute. Then Russ showered and dressed, and I thought, what can I give him to remember me by? I wished I'd dived down at Waterlemon and picked up a shell or a piece of coral, some island token, but I hadn't. And so I rummaged through the desk in the room and found a postcard with a picture of the sugar mill on the front, and I wrote, "I'm going to miss you." I signed it with the initials ML for Mona Lisa. I wasn't sure he would figure that out, but I enjoyed imagining him puzzling over it. I stuck the postcard in the side zip pocket of his bag, and right as he was gathering up his things to go, I told him I'd left him a surprise in that pocket that he should look at before returning home. The last thing I wanted was for Irene to find it. He held my face in his hands. Out the window, I could see the yacht anchored and a crew member pulling the skiff around. It fit somehow underneath the boat or inside of it. Russ kissed me hard and deep. It was the kiss you give someone when you're absolutely, positively never going to see her again.
"I don't have anything to leave you with except for that," he said.
Then he turned and left the room, and I was so addled, so undone, that I hung in the doorway and watched him trudge through the sand. He raised an arm to Todd Croft, who was standing on the deck of the boat. Bluebeard was the yacht's name. I hadn't noticed that before. I saw Todd Croft see me. His head tilted and his smile grew wider, and I disappeared into the shadows of the room, cursing myself. I was wearing my swim cover-up. If Todd asked, Russ could say we'd struck up a friendship and I'd come to say goodbye. It didn't matter. I would likely never see Todd Croft again, but I regretted not leaving first. I should have headed for home an hour or two earlier, but that would have meant losing time with Russ, and I hadn't wanted to do that. For my greed, then, I was punished. I became the one who was left behind. As I drove home, I thought of how the weekend had been a Cinderella story, minus the part with the glass slipper. I was returned to my ordinary self, in my proverbial rags, facing my scullery work. The only part of that magical story I could claim was that I had enjoyed a night, in my case two nights, of bliss. I had successfully charmed a prince, only the prince was a Midwestern corn syrup salesman, a married corn syrup salesman. Mama was at work when I got home, despite the holiday, and I was momentarily relieved. Now I'm locked in my room, writing this down, because supposedly getting it out is a kind of catharsis. I have an hour left to get ready before I have to go back to Keneal, where I will work and pretend that everything is just fine. February 23rd, 2006. I've decided that Bluebeard is an appropriate name for the yacht that delivered Russ to me and then took him away. He was a pirate. He stole my heart. March 30th, 2006. Mama was the one who noticed that I looked peaked and that I wasn't eating much. When had I ever said no to her blackened mahi tacos with pineapple mango salsa? Never was the answer. But they just didn't seem appealing. Nothing seemed appealing. She said, "Do you want to come to the clinic at lunchtime tomorrow and I'll slide you in?" I couldn't tell her that I was suffering from a broken heart, and there's no cure for that except time. And for all the technological advances going on in the world, no one has figured out how to speed time up or slow it down or stop it. Whoever figures out that trick is going to be rich. "Nah," I said. "No, but thanks for offering," Mama prompted. I retreated to my room. I needed to put less energy into pining for the pirate and more into saving money so I could get a place of my own. Then, a couple of days ago, I woke up feeling dizzy and nauseated and I thought, damn it, I really am sick. I had planned to go to Salomon Bay. The best thing for me to do was get back into a routine, but it looked like it would be the clinic instead. I raced to the bathroom and puked into the toilet. I heard Mama knocking on my bedroom door, asking if I was all right. And then I heard Huck say, "Leanne, leave the poor girl alone. No one likes to be bothered when they're praying to the porcelain god." And Mama said, "You're right, handsome. I'll leave her be. She'll be okay, as long as it's not morning sickness." Morning sickness, I thought. It was off to the Chelsea drugstore for a test, but I had to wait until my mother's friend Fatima left for lunch, because Rosie Small buying a pregnancy test would win Fatima a gold medal in the Gossip Olympics. I hurried home, praying, and then I peed on the stick. I'm pregnant. April 30th, 2006. Today, a package addressed to me was hand-delivered to the house. The package contained $10,000 in cash. I'm being bought off. There wasn't a note, but I don't have to be a wizard to know the money is from Todd Croft. But has Todd Croft told Russ that I'm pregnant? Let me go back. When I found out I was pregnant 4 weeks ago, all I could think was that I needed to tell Russ. I was pretty sure he would offer to help. And by help, a part of me was thinking he would leave his wife, move to St. John, and raise this baby with me. It was a long shot, I knew, but not impossible. Maybe instead of making Russ's marriage stronger, the weekend affair, I'm shying away from the word fling, had been a breaking point. Maybe Russ would say yes to the job and goodbye to Irene and start a whole new life. The boys were teenagers. The older boy was headed to college in the fall, and the younger one was only a year or two behind, so they were nearly out of the house. If anyone was poised for a second act, it was Russ. Or so I let myself momentarily believe. I called Iowa City Information and asked for the phone number for Russell or Irene Steele. "Irene Steele," the operator said. "Hold for the number." I hung up the phone. The listing was under Irene's name. She paid the bills. She was in charge of the household. She intimidated me. Indeed, scared me, even from afar. I would never call the house, I decided. I wasn't that desperate. I had to somehow circumvent Irene. I needed an email. I knew there was probably an email attached to the room reservation at Keneal. I had worked at Keneal long enough to know that all reservations were kept in a database, but that database couldn't be accessed on any of the restaurant computers. So I would have to ask the restaurant manager, Estella, to get it for me. I said to her, "Please don't tell my mother." Estella rolled her eyes as if to say, "Rosie, child, no matter how you implore me, you know I could never keep a secret from Leanne." "But a gentleman who stayed here over President's Day weekend begged me for the conch fritter recipe. He wants to give it to the chef at his country club so they can serve them at his wife's surprise birthday party, and I promised him I'd send him the recipes for the fritters and the aioli. He gave me his email, but I lost it, Estella, and I feel terrible. I remember he said his wife's birthday is May 23rd because that's a day after mine, and so time is of the essence. Can you help me find the man's email, please, Estella? I want to provide the kind of service Keneal is famous for." Estella huffed for a minute. Didn't I know that accessing the guest's personal information was forbidden? I said, "But he already gave it to me and I lost it. It's his wife's 40th birthday." Estella hesitated. Then she ushered me into the back office and together we looked. The name Russell Steele didn't turn up in the system, which was perplexing. Had he used a fake name? Was he not only a pirate but an imposter? Then I said, "Let's check the name Todd Croft." And it popped right up. Room 718 for two nights. Total bill $1,652. There was an email, but it was Todd's, and my heart sank, though I did think it was encouraging that it was a BVI email address. I copied it down and thanked Estella, who closed the file and hurried us out of the office, saying, "That was the easy part. Good luck convincing Chef to hand over his recipes." I wrote to Todd Croft, explained who I was, and said merely that I would like an email address for Russ so that I could send him the conch fritter and aioli recipes that he'd requested. But I guess Mr. Croft saw right through my ploy, because here I am, holding 10 large. I know I should feel insulted, but all I feel is relieved, because if Mama kicks me out, and she very well might, I'll have money to get a place for me and the baby. I'm telling her tomorrow. May 1st, 2006. I was so nervous that I got out of bed early after barely sleeping all night. I couldn't wait another hour, another minute. Once I heard both Mama and Huck in the kitchen, I walked down the hall, comforted by the idea that in 30 seconds the secret would be out. They could holler, they could scream, call me names, and cast me out, but all of that would pale against the relief of speaking the truth. When Mama saw me, she was shocked. "Rosie? What are you doing awake? Is everything all right?" In that second, everything was still all right. Mama was dressed for work in her raspberry scrubs and her white lab coat, her towering bun wrapped in a brightly patterned scarf. She'd had her nails done. She was vain about her nails, and they were the same shade of raspberry, and I noticed her fingers against the white porcelain of her coffee cup. Every morning, Huck makes her coffee, one poached egg, and a piece of lightly buttered wheat toast. Huck was standing at the stove tending to the egg. He was wearing cargo shorts with a lure hanging from the belt loop and a long-sleeved t-shirt advertising the Mississippi. He had a bandana wrapped around his neck and was ready for a day of fishing. I didn't dread Huck's anger. What I dreaded was his disappointment in me. We'd had a rocky start to our relationship. When he started courting Mama 7 years ago, I resented him. I thought, he sees a single woman and her wayward daughter and thinks they need to be saved. But we don't need to be saved. But I quickly grew to love Huck and, yes, to count on him. I remember one time when he'd told me to help myself to $20 from his wallet so I could go into town to meet my friends. I found a folded-up, faded picture of Huck with another woman. The picture was obviously old, from the 70s or 80s. In it, Huck was a young man. He had a full head of strawberry blonde hair and a mustache, but no beard. He wore jeans with what looked like a white patent leather belt and a Led Zeppelin t-shirt. The woman was in a crocheted chevron print dress and had on white patent leather boots. Her blonde hair was feathered, and she wore too much black eyeliner. I took the picture to Huck and said, "Who's this?" Huck had had a sister who had died of cancer, and I thought maybe this was her. He rarely talked about her, but I knew her name was Caroline.
"Her?"
Huck said. I thought he might be angry that I'd snooped in his wallet for more than just the 20, but he didn't seem angry.
"That's my first wife, Kimberly."
I was shocked by this. I didn't know Huck had been married before. I felt affronted, maybe even betrayed, for Mama's sake, but also my own. He and Mama had been married a year or two when I found this picture, and the three of us had become a happy family. I didn't like the idea of sharing Huck with anyone. "I didn't realize you'd been married before," I swallowed. "Does my mother know?"
"Yes, of course," he said.
He smiled sadly.
"Sorry, Rose, I should have told you. There just never seemed to be an appropriate time, and it doesn't matter anyway."
"If it doesn't matter, why do you keep the picture?" I asked. I handed it back to him, though really I wanted to tear it to shreds.
"Well,"
Huck said. He thought about it for a minute. "One thing I love most about Huck is that he's a straight shooter. He doesn't candy coat the truth or brush it away because he doesn't want me to see it."
"Kimberly ended up being a disappointment to me. She was an alcoholic, a really, really mean drunk, and that destroyed our marriage. It destroyed just about all of her relationships, actually. But in this picture, we were happy. So I keep it as a reminder that my time with her wasn't all bad."
He slipped the picture back into the wallet.
"In even the bleakest situations, there's usually some good to be salvaged."
Facing Mama and Huck to tell them I was pregnant was a bleak situation. Would any good be salvaged from it? "I'm pregnant," I said. Huck turned from the stove.
"What?"
Mama said. "I'm pregnant." She set down her coffee cup and stood up. Her face was unreadable. Shock, I suppose. Huck was watching her.
"Oscar?"
she said. "Not Oscar," I said. "It was a man at the hotel, someone you don't know. I was stupid. He's gone now, and I don't know how to reach him." There was a moment of such profound silence that I felt like the world had stopped. She was probably deciding whether or not to believe me. Then, finally, she opened her arms, and I entered them. Part 3. The Soggy Dollar. Irene. Before she leaves for St. John, Irene has some loose ends to take care of. A death certificate issued by the Department of Vital Statistics of the British Virgin Islands arrives in the mail in an unmarked envelope. Is it authentic? It seems so, though Irene has no way of knowing for sure. So, obviously, Paulette received her message. There's no note, no invoice, no mention of a fee. Irene has assumed that Paulette is the one who pays to maintain the villa. Taxes. Do they have taxes in the Virgin Islands? Insurance, landscapers, repairs, etc.? Probably out of a fund that Russ or Todd Croft set up. With cash. She takes the death certificate to Ed Sorley's office and drops it off with the receptionist, then leaves before Ed appears with questions. She withdraws $8,000 from the account at Federal Republic using the drive-through window. The cash and the postcards from ML go right into Irene's suitcase. At Lydia's insistence, Irene puts an obituary in the Press Citizen, and she phones her close friends and neighbors to invite them to the house for a memorial reception. She tells them that Russ was killed in a helicopter crash. Lightning was the cause. He was down in the Virgin Islands for work. He's been cremated and the ashes scattered. This is a small gathering so his friends can pay their respects. No food and no flowers, Irene told them. I'm taking some time away, leaving Monday. If you feel you must do something to honor his passing, you can donate to the Rotary Club Scholarship Fund. It always goes to some terrific kid who really needs it. Lydia arranges for the Lynn Street Cafe to cater the reception, and Irene is grateful. Under normal circumstances, she would insist on doing everything herself, but these aren't normal circumstances. The people from the cafe will drop off sandwiches, quiche, salads, and urns of coffee. Irene chills wine and rolls her drinks trolley into the parlor. With so many people in the room, it will be too warm to light a fire, and Irene will be so busy visiting that she won't have time to tend it. Irene is anxious about facing everyone. She doesn't want to be the recipient of sympathy or to be asked any probing questions. She nearly succumbs to the temptation of taking an Ativan right before the reception begins. She has the prescription bottle in her hand, but the doorbell rings and Irene hurries downstairs. It's Lydia, attended by Brandon the barista, who looks far more distinguished out of his leather apron. He's holding Lydia's hand, and with his other hand, he offers Irene a platter of cookies. Homemade, he says, lemongrass sugar. Irene tries out a smile. Lydia looks radiant. She and Brandon are delirious with infatuation, and Irene is, of course, happy for her friend. Brandon and Lydia take charge of setting out the food and cups for coffee and filling buckets with ice, leaving Irene idle to steep in her dread and count the minutes until she boards the plane. The doorbell rings again. Irene mentally pulls herself up by her bootstraps. Compared to what she's been through already, this is nothing. This is easy. And for a while, it's not so bad. The Kinseys arrive, followed by the Dunns, Ed Sorley and his wife Anita, Dot, the nurse from Brown Deer, and some of the neighbors. Nearly everyone from the magazine attends, including Irene's boss, Joseph Feeney, Mavis Key, and the receptionist, Dolores, who brings her newly retired husband, Rooney. Rooney is something of a blunderbuss. He's always the first to get drunk and obnoxious at the holiday party. He speaks without thinking, he's a know-it-all. Honestly, Irene can't stand him. Thankfully, he leaves Dolores to gush out the condolences. I'm so sorry, Irene, none of us had any idea, but it was unusual for you to be out for an entire week without any notice. Of course, once we learned that Millie had passed, it all made sense. None of us knew that Russ... I mean, you've had such a double whammy! A little while later, Irene notices Rooney pouring himself a scotch at the drinks trolley. She needs to find Lydia and tell her to keep an eye on him. But she's too busy. She has to spend time with everyone, nodding her head and lying by omission. Why is it the people you'd like to leave the party first are always the last to go? The party has thinned out to just Irene, Lydia and Brandon, Dot, Ed and Anita Sorley, and Dolores and Rooney. Irene finally allows herself to eat something, a lemongrass sugar cookie, and Brandon, ever the barista, steeps her a tea that he thinks will complement the cookie. Irene nearly laughs at the absurdity of the notion. It's a cookie, Brandon, she wants to say. Irene hasn't tasted anything since Russ died, except the fish that Huck grilled. That had been delicious. Her thoughts are interrupted by Rooney, who raises his voice above the others and says, Russ worked for a hedge fund, right? You're aware, I assume, that the Virgin Islands were recently added to a blacklist of tax havens by the EU? What kind of business was Russ involved in? Are you sure it was above board? Brandon, possibly attempting to head Rooney away from the topic, makes things worse.
What does that mean, a blacklist of tax havens?
He looks around the room and shrugs.
I can explain the difference between a latte and an Americano, but tax havens confound me.
What does it mean? Rooney asks in a way that makes it clear he isn't sure what it means. He's sitting in the velvet-upholstered Bergère chair, holding court now.
It means they conduct business without obeying the tax code. We're talking money laundering, numbered accounts at banks in Switzerland and the Cayman Islands, shell companies, dark money, terrorists, drug dealers, human traffickers.
Irene shoots a look at Ed Sorley.
The Cayman Islands?
Dolores emits a nervous laugh.
Rooney, stop, she says. You knew Russ. He was the nicest man in the world is what he was.
I second that, Dot says.
Sometimes it's the nice guys who are the worst criminals, Rooney says, because they're the ones you'd least suspect of anything.
Irene stands up.
I'm feeling a little worn out, she says,
and everyone takes the hint. Monday afternoon, Irene's ferry pulls in among the powerboats and catamarans moored in Cruz Bay, and Irene scans the crescent of white sand that's home to a string of open-air restaurants backed by palm trees. She feels like she can breathe again. It's bizarre that the place her husband conducted his wild and massive deception has become her refuge. Irene doesn't want to overthink this, and she doesn't want to fight it. She's now experiencing the emotions one should feel upon arriving on St. John, anticipation and joy. Both of her boys are here, and her grandson. It feels like an embarrassment of riches, all of them choosing to be together this time, choosing to be in the paradise Russ unwittingly brought them to. Cash had texted Irene the night before to let her know that today was his first day as a crew member aboard Treasure Island. He thought he'd be back in time to pick Irene up, but if not, he'd send Baker. However, when Irene steps off the ferry and grabs her luggage, two rolling suitcases that contain sundresses, sandals, plenty of bathing suits, and some old fishing shirts that she used to wear out on Clark Lake, she doesn't see either Cash or Baker, and she's annoyed. Have they forgotten her?
Irene!
Irene looks around. Huck is in the parking lot, standing in front of his truck. Irene can't believe the feeling that overcomes her. She ducks her head so he can't see her smiling. Get a grip, she thinks. It's just Huck.
Oh, hi, she says.
She grabs her luggage and starts rolling it over to his truck.
Are you here for me?
Baker took Floyd to the Gift Hill School and Maya wanted to show them around, Huck says. So that left me free to pick you up.
Things are really happening then. Cash started a job. Floyd will go to school. Irene opens the passenger door to Huck's truck.
Wait a minute, Huck says.
He strides over and puts his hands on her shoulders and looks her in the eye.
It's good to see you, Angler Cupcake. I'm glad you're back.
Irene feels herself reddening.
Stop it, she says. You're embarrassing me.
On the way to Russ's villa, Irene thinks it best to fill Huck in on what's been happening. She says,
I've had a visit from the FBI.
Huck says,
I'm afraid that might have been my fault. I had a call from an agent down here right after you left to let me know that they'd opened an investigation into the crash.
Yes, Irene says. The boys and I received calls as well.
And then I contacted Agent Vasco myself last week to let her know that, well, we found money in Rosie's room.
Irene gazes out the window, trying to focus on the views. The vista of the neighboring islands across the turquoise water is nothing short of spectacular. Less than a month ago, Irene made the same drive, but she saw nothing, noticed nothing.
Money.
How much?
A lot.
How much, Huck?
$125,000.
$125,000. A hot, nauseating panic rises in Irene's chest.
In cash, you mean?
Yes, in cash. Bricks of it.
And they took it?
They took it, Huck says. He lights a cigarette and blows the smoke out his window. And I heard they paid a visit to Welcome to Paradise Real Estate.
Dear God, Irene says. Paulette?
She left the island. Her husband and her son, too.
She left the island? Irene says. I called and left a message asking for a certified copy of the death certificate, and she never returned my call, but then, voila, a copy came in the mail.
Well, that's good, Huck says, right?
I thought Russ was still alive somewhere, Irene says. I had these dreams where he was so vivid, so present, so whole. He was there three-dimensionally in my mind, and when I'd wake up, I'd think, he made it out of that helicopter, and Croft plucked him out of the sea and whisked him away. Irene is mortified when her voice breaks. I thought he was just hiding somewhere. I thought I'd see him again. Huck takes Irene's hand. Irene looks down to see their fingers intertwined, her hand slender and wrinkled and white, his large and wrinkled and brown. The FBI didn't find anything in Iowa, Irene says. Did they find anything in your house other than the money? Did they find anything in Rosie's room?
Not that I know of, Huck says. I had Ayers go through Rosie's things while Maya was at school. Ayers was the one who discovered the money.
But not anything else? Irene says. No clues? No explanations?
No, Huck says.
And we can trust Ayers? Irene asks. We don't think she knows more than she's saying, do we?
I trust her, Huck says. She's just as in the dark as you and me.
But she was Rosie's best friend, Irene says. Her confidant. Surely—
Where the invisible man was concerned, Rosie was a brick wall, Huck says. He signals to turn up Lover's Lane. Sorry, I mean Russ.
It's okay, Irene says. The nickname fits. When they get to the house, they see both Jeeps are gone. The boys must still be out. Huck brings Irene's luggage up the stone steps to the deck. Will you stay for a beer? Irene asks.
I should go collect Maya, he says.
No, of course, Irene says. She needs to shower and unpack. The news of the FBI, the cash, and Paulette leaving the island has Irene rattled. Are you worried, Huck? Does it feel like the fire is getting a little close?
I'm concerned, Huck says. I want to remain informed and aware, but I'm not going to let this whole mess control me. This has nothing to do with us, AC. I have a clean conscience, and I know you do as well.
I do, Irene says.
I'll tell you if we ever have reason to worry, he says. Will you trust me on that?
Irene nods. It's remarkable how much better she feels knowing Huck's on her side. If he's not going to worry, she isn't either.
I'll take a rain check on the beer, Huck says. I promise. And hey, we have an afternoon charter on Wednesday. Two couples from Wichita.
So you haven't had second thoughts? Irene says. You still want me to be your first mate?
I need you to be my first mate, Huck says.
I'll come on Wednesday and we'll see how I do, okay? But I promise I won't be offended if you want to hire some young guy. She winks at him. Or young woman.
Agent Vasco was quite attractive, Huck says. I nearly offered her the job.
Oh, was she? Irene says. She sounds jealous to her own ears.
Are you jealous? Huck asks.
Are you trying to make me jealous? Irene says.
I dunno. Maybe.
Well, maybe it worked, Irene says. She's afraid to look Huck in the eye, so she busies herself by rolling her suitcases over to the slider. Thank you for coming to get me. I'll see you Wednesday. Huck smiles at her, shaking his head, and she thinks, what, what? She shoos him away, and he heads down the stairs. Only once he's gone can Irene get a clear breath. She is so keyed up when he's around, both agitated and happy. Agent Vasco was attractive. Bah! Before she goes into the house, Irene stands at the stone wall and inhales the sight of the sea and the verdant island mountains and the lush hillside below. It's the prettiest place she's ever seen. But what is she doing here? It's truly insane, this decision to move down to work on a fishing boat. Has she lost her mind? Well, yes, Irene thinks. She probably has. And good for her. Airs. On Tuesday night, Mick announces that he's going over to St. Thomas the next morning and he won't be back until late, so he can't meet Ayers after her charter with a smoothie.
I guess the honeymoon is over, Ayers says. I knew it wouldn't last. What's happening in St. Thomas?
Picking up some stuff for the bar, Mick says.
Really? Ayers says. Like what? From where?
Stuff from places, Mick says. Paper straws, for one thing. I have to take all the plastic straws to recycling and replace them with paper straws, which, although environmentally friendly, disintegrate once they come in contact with liquid, thereby providing a poor straw experience.
And what else?
What's with the third degree? Mick asks.
She didn't sleep with Baker. When he pulled up alongside of her out of the blue, she thought, is this really happening? And then, without thinking twice, she'd climbed into the car with him and directed him to Hawk's Nest. She thought they would just sit in the parking lot and talk, but that wasn't very romantic. So she led him down the path toward the beach, which was deserted, and she thought, is that what I want? Romantic? The truth is, she hasn't stopped thinking of him since he left. She doesn't want to like him, but she does. And reading Rosie's journals is screwing with her head. Rosie willingly had an affair with a man she knew was married. Ayers' own dear, sweet friend, a person Ayers admired and respected, did that. The story in the diary is, at least, providing some context. Russ was unhappy, at a crossroads career-wise, and he'd been dropped into paradise for the weekend, where he'd met Rosie, who even on her worst day was achingly beautiful. Something had sparked between them, then ignited. It's the spark and the flame that intrigue Ayers. Did two good people do something they knew was wrong because there was some kind of magical chemistry involved? Or was it plain old human fallibility, weakness in the face of temptation? Ayers isn't sure. What she is drawn to in Rosie's journal is the rawness of Rosie's desire for Russ and her pain when he leaves. Has Ayers ever felt that way about anyone? Does she feel that way about Mick? She was hurt and angry, really angry, when she found Mick with Bridget, but that pain might simply have been the blow to her self-esteem and the sting of being rejected. The truth is, the way she feels about Mick now has changed. She still loves him, but she doesn't trust him and she doesn't trust herself. And sometimes she thinks she went back to him only because it was comfortable and familiar, whereas the idea of embarking on a whole new relationship with Baker Steele is terrifying and unrealistic. He's still married. He lives in Houston. Once they were on the beach, Baker reached for Ayers' hand, but she batted him away, then turned to confront him. There wasn't a moon. It was really dark. Ayers could barely see Baker, but despite this, there was an instant pull of attraction. He was so tall and broad. She loved having to crane her neck to look up at him. He had a fresh haircut, she'd noticed. It looked good with his chiseled features and his dimple. He'd gone soft around the middle, and there was something dad-like and a little nerdy in his demeanor. But these things set her at ease. I didn't bring you here for that, Ayers said. I want to talk. Baker nodded.
Yeah, me too. Sorry. It's a beach. We were walking. I've been thinking of you every second of every day since I left, so believe me when I say that reaching for your hand was something I did instinctively.
I need to know a couple things, she said. One, are you still married?
Legally, yes, Baker said. It's only been a few weeks. But Anna, my wife, accepted a surgical post at the Cleveland Clinic with her girlfriend Louisa, so they're moving and giving me physical custody of Floyd.
Have you started divorce proceedings? Ayers asked. Have you spoken to a lawyer?
We're using a mediator, Baker said, and yes, I've spoken to her. This is happening. There's no going back. I actually had dinner with Anna and Louisa a few days ago, and wow, they're together. Two peas in a pod. An intimidating pair.
Intimidating, Ayers thought, because they weren't sexually attracted to men. Ayers let Baker's typical attitude slide because she had a more pressing question. How long are you staying down here?
We're moving here, Baker said. I have Floyd with me. I want to put him in school.
This wasn't the answer Ayers was expecting. So you packed up all your stuff and shipped it down here?
Well, Baker said.
No, she didn't think so. It would have been too good to be true.
We're here for 2 weeks. Then I have to go back to Houston for this event at Floyd's school,
which he was supposedly pulling Floyd out of.
And then I'll take care of packing up the rest of what we need.
So it's your intention to move down here, Ayers said. But if after 2 weeks you aren't feeling it, you'll go back to Houston.
It's my intention to stay, Baker said. Cash is staying. And tonight I found out my mother is coming down, so I'll have a built-in support system.
Irene, Ayers thought. She had a whole new set of feelings about Irene now that she'd read Rosie's journals. Mostly fear that she, Ayers, could someday be duped and blindsided as badly as Irene had been. It was so important to stay vigilant where your heart was concerned. Why didn't they teach you that in school?
What about a job? Ayers said. Cash has a job, with me.
Even in the darkness, she could see Baker wince.
I won't believe you're staying until you have something tethering you to this island.
I'm going to look for a job, Baker said. I day trade for money. I can do that anywhere, which is how I'm able to pick up and leave Houston. But I want something part-time here, something flexible so I can still be around for Floyd. I admit I don't have any leads yet. I just got here today. The first thing I wanted to do was find you.
I'm still with Mick, Ayers said.
I know, Baker said. Cash told me.
He reached out and touched a strand of her hair.
I'm not going to put any pressure on you. I just want you to know that I'm here because of you.
Against her wishes, this affected her. I'm with Mick, she said again, weakly.
Well, if things don't work out with Mick, I'll be here waiting. He grinned. Like a complete idiot.
An utter fool. She laughed. Then they stood smiling at each other, and she thought, he's going to try and kiss me. He bent down toward her, but stopped.
Come on, he said. I'll take you back to town.
Wednesday morning, Ayers drives down to Treasure Island, and Mick follows behind her in his blue Jeep, with Gordon hanging his head over the side. They're on their way to the ferry. Mick honks as he peels off. They have a full boat today, 20 people, 6 of them kids, and handling that is a tall order, especially because it's only Cash's third day of work, his first without Wade there to train him. But Cash seems to be a natural when it comes to managing groups of strangers all keyed up for an adventure. He's courteous and convivial, he has the gift of gab, and it's clear that he takes his procedural responsibilities, the passport paperwork, tying up at the docks, cleaning and prepping all the snorkel equipment, and assisting with any young, old, or infirm guests, very seriously. Of course, this job offers a different roll of the dice each and every day. That's one of the things Ayers likes about it. Occasionally, there are mechanical issues with the boat, or the weather isn't great, but that's for Captain James to deal with. Ayers and Cash handle the humans. Ayers goes to the top deck to put out the seat cushions. 6 kids is a lot, she thinks, especially if the parents start drinking. She decides to tell Cash that she'll manage the kids and he'll be in charge of the adults. Adults are easier. Most of the time. From her perch, Ayers spies Mick on the top deck of the ferry, Gordon, with him on a leash, garnering attention from every dog lover on the boat. Mick took Gordon with him because, with both Ayers and Mick gone all day, there'd be no one to let him out. Still, Ayers suspects Mick also brought Gordon, because Gordon is a chick magnet. And sure enough, a girl with long brown hair in a cute white sundress takes the seat next to Mick. The girl puts her arm around Mick and lays her head on his shoulder, so it must be someone they know. Ayers squints. The girl lifts her head and turns. It's Bridget. To get some stuff for the bar, Ayers thinks. Paper straws. This is such bullshit, Ayers can't believe she bought it. Well, she didn't quite buy it, did she? She'd had a funny feeling because Mick hated going to St. Thomas. If there was a reason to go, he'd send one of his employees. But when Ayers asked follow-up questions, he'd accused her of giving him the third degree, and she hadn't argued the point because she was feeling guilty about the journals and about seeing Baker. Bridget! Where is he going with Bridget? To the recycling center and the restaurant supply store? Or to the Tap and Still for a long boozy lunch followed by... What? Not back until late, he said. What a jerk. Gordon puts his paws up on Bridget's knees and starts licking her face, and Ayers turns away. If she watches any longer, she's going to be sick. She pulls her phone out of her shorts pocket, and as she's wondering what to text to Mick, what can she say that will make him feel as nauseated as she feels right now? Cash calls up the stairs.
Paperwork is ready, he says. Permission to board?
Permission granted, James says from the wheelhouse.
Ayers's phone says it's 8:10. Time to get everyone on so they can leave. She shoves her phone back into her shorts pocket, then whips it back out and shoots a quick text to Mick. I saw you with Bridget. Please don't ever call me again. It's over. She feels triumphant, but it lasts only an instant. Bridget! The six children are all in the same family, the Dresslers, and they're all boys, tow-headed and tan, ranging in age from 14 to 6. They all have D names, DJ, Danny, Damien, Duncan, Donner, like the reindeer, the mother says, and Dougie. Who names a child after a reindeer? Ayers wonders. She's in a foul mood. The kids seem relatively well-behaved, and the parents, Dave and Donna, are a striking couple, tall and superior-looking. Donna carries a bag, as big as Santa's, that holds the entire family's snorkeling equipment. You just never know what you're going to get, Ayers thinks. Today, it's a cross between the Von Trapp children and Russian Matryoshka dolls. She finds Cash in the cabin. He's setting out the platter of fruit and the sliced coconut banana bread. The greatest thing about Cash is he doesn't mind the menial jobs. He thinks it's a privilege. And Cash is clearly skilled with a knife. The fruit is uniformly sliced and spread out in an appetizing pinwheel. Ayers pulls Cash aside. I'll keep a close eye on the boys. You take the so-called grown-ups.
Got it, boss, he says.
He turns from Ayers and smiles at a young woman who is hanging by the counter.
What can I get for you?
When does the bar open? The young woman asks.
Ayers has to wait a beat before she answers. This happens every day, but Ayers is in no mood right now for someone whose sole reason for coming aboard Treasure Island is to get shit-faced. No alcohol until we're underway, Ayers says, and even then, I'd urge you to be prudent until the snorkeling portion is over.
Prudent is my middle name, she says, but snorkeling is quite a while from now, isn't it?
Yes, Ayers says. Baths first, including travel, that takes 2 hours. Then the captain will pick a snorkeling spot. We should be finished snorkeling by 11 or 11:30.
That's a long time to be prudent, the woman says.
Ayers feels herself about to snap. Once we are on our way to Yost, you can drink as much as you want.
Cash says, If prudent is your middle name, what's your first name?
He sticks out a hand. I'm Cash.
I'm Maxwell, she says.
That's your first name? Cash asks.
Afraid so, she says. It's kind of confusing, but don't worry. I'm very female.
She sticks her chest out at Cash, and Ayers notices a tattoo.